Well, hi, everyone. If you turn in your Bible or your device to 1 Kings chapter 17 today, we're in week two of this series called Preparing for God's Power. You know, as you read the Bible, like, spiritual power was something that seemed to be baked into the lives of the ancient saints, the early Christians. And so, you know, we're asking the question, why are we not expectant that God would move in power in our lives and in our day? And what would it look like if God's power were unleashed, like in your life or in our church? But that doesn't just happen. Like, it requires a process of preparation, of weeding some stuff out, some dialing some other stuff in. And so to help us, we're looking at the story of Elijah and ultimately at one of God's greatest expressions of power in the ancient world, when God's fire fell on the top of Mount Carmel and defeated the false prophets and the Baals. And so we're looking at what led up to that moment, the backstory a little bit. And so last week, we explored the idea of how to assume a posture of total dependence. And today, the title of my message is Take Steps of Great Faith. So we're picking up the story of 1 Kings 17 in verse 7, but let me just fill you in on a couple of blanks to get our minds engaged back in the story. So Israel is under the political rule of the most evil king in their history named Ahab. And he's married an incredibly evil woman named Jezebel. She's come into Israel from a neighboring nation and brought with her 400 pagan prophets. And she sent them out into every corner of the kingdom to turn Israel into an idol-worshiping nation. And at the same time, she began slaughtering all of Israel's priests and prophets who'd been established by the one true God. And so Elijah, one of Israel's prophets, stood as the last true hope of Israel, the only prophet left who could save his people. And so the future of Israel is hanging in the balance. And last week, Elijah stood before Ahab, the king, and he challenged his so-called God of rain and harvest by declaring that there was going to be a drought in the land until Elijah said that there wouldn't be any more. And so the drought ended up lasting 3.5 years. This is all setting up a showdown in the next chapter. Fire is going to fall from heaven on Mount Carmel, and God is going to use Elijah to display his amazing power. And so Elijah makes this bold declaration before the king that there's going to be a drought. And he drops the mic, and then God tells him to leave and to go into hiding near a brook called Kereth, where God miraculously provides food from some ravens each day. Meanwhile, there's a nationwide manhunt for Elijah. And all these events have to do with Elijah's preparation. God is preparing him for when God's power will be unleashed, and when God will show his people again which God is the real God. This is Elijah's life mission. Even his name, Elijah, means the Lord is God, which kind of gives us the punchline of his whole life. But before God's power is going to show up, he's going to need to do a deep work in Elijah's heart. The same thing is true for us. We have to prepare the altar of our hearts for God's power to be demonstrated. And so today we're going to move from last week's lesson on dependency to some learnings about faith. And so here's today's big idea. God uses small tests of faith to prepare us for the great ones. We're going to be in 1 Kings 17, 7 through 24. It says, "And after a while, the brook dried up because there was no rain in the land. And then the word of the Lord came to Elijah, 'Arise, go to Zarephath, which belongs to Sidon, and dwell there. Behold, I have commanded a widow there to feed you.' And so he arose and went to Zarephath." Now, I want to stop right here and introduce the framework that I want to use to work through this passage today. I think we're going to notice as we go through the text that little tests of Elijah's faith are preparing him for the boldest moment of great faith in his life. Little tests that will lead to great faith. This is a pattern that God has always used with his children, including you and me, by the way. And so as we work through today's passage, we're going to see four tests of great faith. They're little in the moment, but they're going to lead to that great moment. So right off the bat, the brook where God was providing for Elijah dried up. And so he says to him, "Go to Zarephath." And here's the first test. Will you leave what's comfortable? Zarephath, the new place, was about 100 miles northwest of Kereth, the old place. And these weren't just any old 100 miles. It's in Sidon, which is Jezebel's home turf. This is where the evil queen is from. This is where the false prophets are from. And so Elijah is told to walk alone 100 miles with no provisions through a desert from basically Erie to Pittsburgh into his enemy's home turf. This word Zarephath means a smelting place. It's a furnace that would look something like this. And in these furnaces, they would produce iron, which would then be used for the construction of weapons and tools. And so Elijah is being sent from the brook into the furnace. He's being shaped and molded in the furnace of God's sharpening to be an instrument in the hands of the Almighty. So not only is the geography a move away from what was comfortable for Elijah, but the person he's told to look for is also pretty shocking. God says to find a widow there. So not only is God sending Elijah into pagan territory for his salvation, he's sending him to a woman and a widow. In that society, women had no rights. And the fact that she was a widow means that she was incredibly poor. And so God sent Elijah to a moral outsider, an ethnic outsider, a gender outsider, and a religious outsider for his provision and even his salvation. God is taking Elijah outside the boundaries of every comfort zone that he had set up. And if you don't think it was a big deal, I want you to look at Jesus' first sermon in Luke chapter 4. He refers to this very story. And at the end of the sermon, Jesus says these words. He says, "There were many widows in Israel in the days of Elijah, and Elijah was sent to none of them, but only to Zarephath in the land of Sidon, to a woman who was a widow." And when Jesus said that in his inaugural sermon, his audience tried to kill him. I remember my first sermon at Grace. Over on 38th Street, it was in 1995, I preached on Luke 15, and I got done preaching, and I actually grabbed a microphone and sang a solo right there at the end. Don't ask. But after I was done with my first sermon, even though looking back now, it was pretty rough, everyone came up to me, and they patted me on my back, and they told me they were proud of me, and my mom and dad took me out for ice cream. And after Jesus' first sermon, they tried to throw him off a cliff because of this story of Elijah and the widow. That's how scandalous it was. And so God says, I'm going to send you to the heretics to save you. In fact, I'm going to save you through her, and I'm going to end up saving her through you. This is just like God and his love for the outsider. But first, he says, you need to leave what's comfortable. You need to leave that brook, and you need to start walking. And so guys, in the spring months of 2022, let me ask you this. Where do you need to leave what has become comfortable for you? Maybe it's stepping up to serve during this time. Maybe it means stepping up in your finances, handling them in a more godly way. Maybe you've been coasting since COVID and playing it safe at work or playing it safe with your faith. You've been excusing yourself from being bold with a friend who needs to hear about the hope of Christ. You've been avoiding having a deep conversation with one of your kids. All I know is that faith isn't developed when you're safe and secure. It's developed when you're uncomfortable. And it's more comfortable to stay right where we are in our little corners, hidden next to our peaceful little babbling brooks. But God is calling you to something greater. And maybe the greater thing involves a small step of faith that you'd least expect out of your comfort zone. God says, go 100 miles into enemy territory, find a dirt poor widow, and just see what I can do. And so Elijah goes. He goes to Zarephath, where he confronts a second test of faith. I want you to look at verse 9. It says, "Behold, I have commanded a widow there to feed you." And so he arose and he went to Zarephath. And when he came to the gate of the city, behold, a widow was there gathering sticks. And he called to her and he said, "Bring me a little water in a vessel that I may drink." And as she was going to bring it, he called to her again and he said, "Bring me a morsel of bread in your hand." So here's the second test of great faith. Will you trust in the people God provides you? There's a little wordplay going on in this text that the ESV doesn't exactly pick up on. Our ESV version says in verse 9, "I've commanded a widow there to feed you." And back up in verse 4, it also says that God commanded the ravens to feed Elijah. But they're actually two different original words. Originally, it says that God arranged for the ravens to feed him, but he appointed the widow. And I think we pick up on a valuable faith lesson if we're going to learn true faith in God, that we must be willing to depend on the people that God brings into our lives. Elijah could have said, "What do you mean a widow's going to feed me? You know, God, you've been feeding me directly from those ravens. Like, I've got a direct line. No middleman required for what God is sending my way. I'm not going to depend on a woman, especially a Phoenician woman who's not from Israel." And yet imagine Elijah arriving at the gate of this pagan city. He just completed his walk from Erie to Pittsburgh. I know some of you extreme fitness types, you know, a marathon is not enough for you guys anymore. And so they created these things called ultra races. And the pinnacle of the ultra race is the 100-mile race. Well, Elijah beat you to it. He just run his 100-mile race. And he said, okay, God, I made it 100 miles. I dodged the bandits and the robbers along the road. My back is hurting from sleeping on the desert ground. My skin is worn and weathered from the sun. I picked up some berries along the way for a little energy and nutrition, but I'm starving. God, I escaped the archers that are guarding the gate on the wall of the city. I made it here, God. But I have to admit, I liked it better by the brook. I liked it better when I was counting on you directly for my room service. But God, here I am. But I'm hungry. I'm desperate for your provision. I'm desperate for you. And just at that moment, Elijah's eyes are drawn to a woman in a ratty old robe, her hair's greasy and disheveled, her stomach's distended and emaciated from her own hunger pangs, face dirty with the scars of poverty. She's collecting wood. You know what she's doing? She's actually preparing a funeral dinner for herself and for her young son. One last meal before they die of starvation. The drought and the resulting famine that Elijah was kind of responsible for have been rough on this little broken family. And so Elijah's like, come on, God. Not her. I mean, she can't even make it on her own. She can't even provide for herself, let alone provide for me. Like, you got any of those ravens left? God, I'd rather do the raven thing again instead of this poor woman. But God whispers, she's the one. And so he swallows his pride and he yells out, hey, can you bring me some water and maybe some of that bread that you're going to make there? I don't know if you've ever had someone in your life that you thought you were going to be the giver and they were going to be the taker and it ends up being the other way around. Like, it happens to me every mission trip we go on. Like, we go there to bless and we get blessed instead. I think it happens with our kids as they get older. Lots of times with friends and other family members. Like, you think your job is to bless them and they end up blessing you. Well, Elijah was skeptical. And yet God had appointed these two to do life together, to depend on one another for a season. To not only trust in him, but to lean in and trust on each other. So who's God appointed for you to do life with? Like, I know this, you weren't meant to do it alone. It's all the rage these days to say, well, I love God, I just don't love the church. Like, I'll worship God by myself, but I don't want to bother with all the people. And listen, I get it, I understand. I have my fill of the people thing sometimes too. But every description of the Christian life in the Bible is in the context of community with the family of God. Because you see, it's only in community that Elijah has this realization that maybe God didn't bring me to Zarephath just to feed me. Maybe he brought me here to feed this widow and her son through me. That it's not just about what God is trying to get to me by way of provision, but part of his provision for me is actually going to involve providing for her. You see, sometimes the way God will bless you is when you pour out his blessing on other people. It's in the pouring out that God's provision comes to you. It's the beauty of community. That if he can give joy through you, maybe he's going to give more joy to you. Like, if he can give encouragement through you, maybe he'll give more encouragement to you. If he can give healing through you, maybe he'll give healing to you. And so at Kereth, Elijah learned God can take care of me. At Zarephath, he learned God can use me to take care of others. These are the things only learned when we choose community. The blessings of God were never meant to dead end with you. They were meant to be passed along. You were never meant to be a cul-de-sac. You were meant to be a highway. You were never meant to be a puddle that collects God's blessings for yourself, but a rushing river that passes them along. And so have you chosen community? Are you trusting the people that God has brought to you for this season of your life? Two tests. Will you leave what's comfortable? And will you trust in the people God provides you? Here's the third test. Look at verse 12. It says, and she said, as the Lord your God lives, I have nothing baked, only a handful of flour in a jar, and a little oil in a jug. And now I'm gathering a couple of sticks that I may go in and prepare it for myself and my son, that we may eat it and die. And Elijah said to her, do not fear. Go and do as you've said, but first, make me a little cake of it and bring it to me, and afterward make something for yourself and your son. And for thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, the jar of flour shall not be spent, and the jug of oil shall not be empty until the day that the Lord sends rain upon the earth. And she went and did as Elijah said, and she and her household ate for many days. the jar of flour was not spent, neither did the jug of oil become empty, according to the word of the Lord that he spoke by Elijah. Here's the third test. Will you be generous with a little? We learn it from the widow herself. We find out here that she's down to her very last meal. The drought has wiped her out, but we're about to learn that great miracles are accomplished during great times of crisis. And so he asks for food, and she responds in verse 12. She said, "As surely as the Lord," notice, "your God lives." It's not my God, it's your God. Actually, a more literal translation probably goes something like this. She says under her breath, "I swear to God, you want bread? Like, you want bread? I've got a handful of flour and a little oil, and I'm out here gathering sticks because me and my boy are about to have our last meal." That, like, the death row warden has come for us, clanging his metal platter, and he said, "This is your last meal before you die. What would you like as your last meal?" And guess what I chose? The same meal I've chosen every day of my life. A little cake of bread, a cracker, and some water. I'm collecting sticks to build a fire to make my own funeral dinner, and you still want your bread, sir? That's my translation. And Elijah responds, "Girl, do your thing. You go make your meal for your little family." Look at verse 13. "But first, make a small cake of bread for me." Now that sounds really selfish, doesn't it? But Elijah is really testing this principle. And it's a principle that Jesus would teach later on in Matthew 6:33. You're familiar with the verse. He says, "Seek first his kingdom and his righteousness. And when you put the needs of the kingdom of God before your own needs, then all of your needs will be met. All these things will be added to you." And so Elijah said, if you're generous with that little that you have, if you put God first in that, then he's going to fill you back up 100-fold. "Serve me my meal first, and God will refill the flour jug and the oil jar." If I were the widow, I'd be very tempted to say, "How about God goes first? How about you tell your God, listen, God, you fill up my flour jug and you fill up my oil jar first, then I'll fix your prophet a sandwich here. But I want to see the miracle first." You ever had that argument with God? You're like, "God, you go first. You provide first, and then I'll take the step of faith." And he usually responds, no. "You take the step of faith first, and then watch me provide." God says, "Will you trust me now with the little that you've got? Because if you don't trust God when you have a little, you're not going to trust him when you get more." People like to say, I hear it all the time, "When I get more, I'll be generous with God. Like, when I get more free time, I'm going to give to God. When I get out of this season of exhaustion and I have more energy, then I'll give to God. Or when I have more money, I'll be more generous with God." But more by itself never ever builds more faith. Faith is built when we're generous when we only have a little. And I've seen it too many times. Trust me, if you're not generous with your little, you will not be generous with your more. Generosity is a matter of the heart. Let me read one of the most amazing statements of faith in verse 15 here. "And she went and did as Elijah said." Remember, her son's life depends on this meal. And instead, she uses all the remaining ingredients on a meal for Elijah. And in that moment, if God doesn't come through, she and her son are dead. On an empty stomach. And so she takes the meal to Elijah. He says, "Thank you so much. But by the way, go look in the jar." And she looks and it's full. God provided. She makes a meal. And then the next morning she goes and looks again and the jar is full again. And the next morning and the next morning and the next morning and the next morning. One day at a time, God is supplying her need. God sees and God cares. And she gave the gift of everything. And then the blessing of the endless flower is this physical picture that the giver of life has invaded her life by his grace. Who would have guessed that such reckless generosity would result in such unexpected blessing? And I want to pause here, guys, for just a moment and ask, how are you doing on the reckless generosity thing? Like, do you continue to be generous even when it feels like you only have a little? Are you being faithful with your tithe? Are you responsive to the needs of the poor? A number of times through our marriage, Kim and I have had the experience of trusting God by giving him more than we thought we had in the jar. We're like, all right, it's time for us to empty this thing on God's kingdom first, and we'll put our little kingdom in the background. And every single time, God has provided more than we ever imagined, and he built our faith. And so even if you only feel like you have a little left, a little time, a little energy, a little money, will you be generous with a little? Will you give it to God first? This is one of the ways that he builds faith in us. Now, this story would be amazing enough if it stopped right here in verse 16, but it doesn't. It takes an even more dramatic turn. All of a sudden, the widow's son is stricken with what seems to be a terminal illness. Like, why in the world would God allow this to happen? Does it make any sense to provide endless provisions for this boy's sustenance and then allow the child to die? Immediately. Shouldn't God be rewarding the widow for her act of faithfulness? It looks like a sick joke from God. Look at verse 17. And after this, the son of the woman became ill. And his illness was so severe that there was no breath left in him. And she said to Elijah, "What have you against me, O man of God? You have come to bring my sin to remembrance and to cause the death of my son." And he said to her, "Give me your son." He took him from her arms and he carried him up into the upper chamber where he lodged, and he laid him down on his bed and he cried out to the Lord, "O Lord my God, have you brought calamity even upon this widow with whom I sojourn by killing her son?" And he stretched himself upon the child three times and he cried out to the Lord, "O Lord my God, let this child's life come into him again." And the Lord listened to the voice of Elijah. The life of the child came into him again and he revived. And Elijah took the child and he brought him down from the upper chamber into the house and delivered him to his mother. And Elijah said, "See, your son lives." And the woman said to Elijah, "Now I know that you're a man of God and that the word of the Lord is in your mouth is truth." Do you know who else needed to know that the word of the Lord that who was in his mouth were true? It was Elijah. He was like, "Whoo! This was such a faith-building moment." He needed to make sure that his words were getting to God's ears. And here's the fourth test of great faith. Will you trust God in adversity? This passage ends with this incredible miracle of resurrection. Verse 18, the boy dies. The widow responds by saying, "I knew it. Like, you came here to judge me for my sins. You caused my son to die." That's a pretty big accusation. But then she asks a very vulnerable question. She says, "Is my boy's death the result of my sins?" Remember, this woman was a pagan. She didn't believe in God. And Elijah, he's different. He's a seminary grad. Like, he has his doctorate in theology. He's supposed to have all the answers. And watch what he does. He doesn't lose his cool at her accusation. He doesn't get defensive. He doesn't turn into the answer man and write a doctoral dissertation. He looks up to heaven and he says, "Lord, is it? Like, is his death a result of her sin?" He doesn't know. He's wondering himself. He's doubting. He's questioning. And instead of making up some religious jargony answer, he wasn't like, "Well, you know, he's going to a better place," or "All things work together for the good of those who love." No, he goes to God and he says, "Is it? Is that what's going on here?" Listen, where you take your questions and pain during times of adversity is one of the most clarifying tests of your faith. You have two options in adversity. You can run to God or you can run away from God. And listen, he can handle whatever you bring to him. Even the most heartbreaking pain, even the most direct questions. The Psalms are filled with language for this. You can run away from God to numb the pain with drink and thrills and distractions, or you can run to him and let him work with you through the adversity, the creator of your soul. Tim Keller points out that this is a evidence of the existence of a true God. The fact that Elijah is asking this question is his way of admitting that God is a sovereign God. He's saying, "God, you have every right to take the life of this boy if you want to, because of this woman's sin." Like, Elijah knows that God actually might be doing this. You say, "Well, that's repulsive. That's offensive. That's why I don't like Christianity." Like, if you follow a God like that, who's going to take the life of a little boy? Like, I don't believe in that God, and surely I won't follow that God. But that's just the point here. It's how we can actually tell a living God versus a fake God. I said earlier, the whole purpose of Elijah's life, even in his name, was to show God's people which God is the real God. You see, an idol, a pretend God, a false God, is a God that you project. It's a God that's an extension of your mind, a God that's under your control. An idol never does things that you don't approve of, because you'll just stop believing in a God like that. But a living God is different. You know you have a living God when he says things and does things that you don't understand or you don't like. Like, if your God never offends you, if he never does or says anything that occasionally dumbfound and upset you, then you have a pretend God. If you're not willing to follow a God who will contradict you, an untamed God, a God who's outside of your control, then you don't have a real God at all. And so you concoct a God, and when you concoct a God like that in your mind, one who's tame and non-offensive, and then you worship that God, you might as well have carved it out of wood because it's pretend. But what we see here in this text is a God who's sovereign, who's free to judge, who gives and takes life. And if you read this account and say, well, I can't believe in a God like that, it's possible that you're going to miss your chance to believe in the one true God. That's how we know he's living. Don't miss the living God. And not a dead God that's lifeless that you made up in your mind. So the boy dies. And in the face of this unwelcome and unfair death, Elijah turns to the living God and he asks the question, did this boy die because of his mother's sins? And God says, no. And he answers Elijah by resurrecting the boy in the most unique way. Elijah lays the boy down and stretches himself out over the little boy. What the heck is that about? Well, there's a lot of debate, but here's the interpretation I'm most inclined to. In John 21, 18, Jesus is forgiving Peter. He's talking about Peter's future. And he says to Peter, Peter, someday you're going to stretch out your hands and people will take you where you don't want to go. And John tells us that by doing this, Jesus was actually predicting how Peter would die, that he would die by crucifixion, that his body would be stretched out on a cross like Jesus was. And so here we see the woman looking to God and asking, is my son paying for my sin? And God looks back and says, no, your son can't pay for your sin. In fact, my son is going to pay for your sin. My son is going to go to a cross. My son is going to be stretched out and he's going to cry out and my son is going to die as a payment for your sin, not your son. And Elijah, in this moment, gives us a little preview of the cross. Will you run to God in your adversity or will you run away from him? Some of you need to understand today that Jesus was stretched out for your sin, that no amount of penance, no amount of church attendance, no number of sleepless nights wallowing in guilt or shame will ever take the place of the saving grace of Jesus who was stretched out for you. And Elijah points us to the good news of Jesus. You know, in this moment of adversity, Elijah cries out to God and God responds in power. And Elijah's time in Zarephath is like a training camp as he gets ready for the Super Bowl of Mount Carmel. It's like Rocky Balboa's little cabin in the mountains as he's training to fight Drago. It's this preparatory school of faith. Elijah's doing some warm-ups. He's doing some one-handed push-ups at the widow's house. He put himself out there in faith and God responded in power. And I want to remind you guys today, God is alive. God is sovereign. He's active. He's real. He's not forgotten you. He's the one true God. And some of you who follow God are wavering right now in your faith. God, why am I here right now? Why, where are you? And Elijah probably had some of those same questions, but God was arranging Elijah's steps. He was preparing Elijah for a greater work. But first, he had to learn to take small steps of faith that would one day lead to a great moment. I wonder what small steps you need to take today so that God's power might show up in your life. I promise I'm wrapping up, but there's this interesting progression that I want you to see from the beginning of the chapter to the end. It's the most important transformation you can ever make in this lifetime. See, in 1 Kings 17:1, I want you to notice what Elijah is called at the very beginning of the chapter. He's defined by where he's from. It says, Elijah the Tishbite. Now, if you look at the very last verse of this chapter, 17:24, Elijah is identified simply as a man of God. He's gone from being defined by where he's from to being defined by who he belongs to. And part of that transformation is that he's passing the tests of faith that God is putting him through. What about you? Are you passing the tests? How are you defined? What gives you confidence as you look to the future? Is it your strengths? How much money you have in the bank? Your earning potential? Is your faith in the fact that your talents or your smarts can guarantee you a good job or that your looks can guarantee you a good husband? That your workout regimen has positioned you for a good long life? Or is your confidence in God? Is your faith in God that he has plans for you? That wherever he leads you, he'll provide for you. And whatever assignments he gives to you, he'll supply for you. That he has a purpose for you to walk in. And so will you look into the future with faith and dependence and say, God, where you tell me to go, I'll go. Whatever you assign to me, I'll do it because I know you're my supply and you can be trusted. I'm ready to take steps of great faith. So as our next step today, I want you to just do one thing. Will you identify one of these tests that applies most closely to your life right now? Like, does God have you in one of these places and he's trying to prepare you to walk in greater power? Is he asking, you know, will you leave what's comfortable? Will you trust in people that God provides you? Or will you be generous with a little? Or will you trust God in adversity? I would love for you to reflect on these faith tests today and just ask God, where do I need to pass the test that you have me in? So will you please take some time to do that right now? And may these smaller tests build in us a greater faith. I love you guys.